Thank you, Don. Welcome back from lunch. Let's try and keep you guys awake. All right, up here you see a pretty weird title for a talk, particularly for one at a technical conference. And it's up there because I just couldn't get it out of my mind. It's like, why is this thing sticking in my mind? And it took me a while to figure out why it was. This morning I kicked off this day-long special session by connecting the dots of the 11 speakers that constitute today's lineup. Today, right now I'm one of those 11 dots, but I'm talking today a little bit about a Minnesota mindset. We said that the entire session here wasn't going to be real technically dense. Well, this one is going to be the lightest weight of them all, probably. It's about a Minnesota mindset and how it colors this state's legacy amendments or the special sales tax thing that we passed. You've heard about it in almost every talk so far and how we got to get all this background data that helps convert conventional wisdom or gut feeling or instincts or intuitions into data we can actually back up some of these claims. And also why we're doing what we're doing now that we've got this money. And I think this title speaks to what is shaping our approach. Minnesotans identify with water. We identify with the lakes and rivers. I mean, it's the whole land of 10,000 lakes, land of sky blue waters sort of thing. And there's a mindset here that earlier today I mentioned how our last three governors of three different parties were smart enough to start hitching their wagon to water quality. And they didn't just do it once or twice or when they were appearing before a natural resource type crowd. They talked about it a lot and how it was our identity. If you were to go find somebody here in downtown Minneapolis who's never landed a walleye or never paddled in the boundary waters and just really doesn't get out that much into the natural resources, if they have relatives in drought-starved Texas or California, I bet your bottom dollar that they bragged them about, oh, the heady scent of pine here in the lakes, I just love it here. It's how we identify with this stuff. In fact, if you made us pick between, are we more extreme northern Iowa or very southern Ontario, people would go, Ontario, and we'd be putting on toques, eating poutine, and complaining about the Maple Leafs instead of the Vikings. It is our identity. So, part of what I'm talking about today is how we got this legacy amendment. And the glaciers did shape us big time, and they left that water heritage. What you're looking at is a topographic colored map of Minnesota. Essentially, it's not a shock, the ice sheets came from the north, which is up. It slid down across the state, scoured out a bunch of stuff, and then pulled back. It left in its wake all those lakes that you see primarily north of the green belt that goes across the waste of Minnesota. That green belt that you see there is a great big pull the cork and watch the floodwaters crank downstream and gouge out the Minnesota River Valley from left to right or west to east. That's where all that water came from, and that's why the glaciers matter so much. I mean, I'm an ag engineer, not a psychologist, but like most engineers, I figure, hey, how hard can this psychology stuff be? That's my perception of what's been going on with this, and I'm gonna back it up, I think. So if you're looking at a similar effort in another state to figure out how can we get some of this money that not only funds the background monitoring or the baseline monitoring, but also some of the research that's going on at the university, but also money to do projects, money to provide incentives, money that a lot of your clientele can put to use to help pay for transitions that they may be facing as policies are shifting. Because they may not want this, but it's coming. And that's what we heard at the panel yesterday. And I'm going to move on now to why that difference in perception matters. So there we were, on the morning of November 5, 2008. A bunch of water professionals in the state got up that morning, ran downstairs to see if Santa had left any gifts under the tree. Did this referendum pass? Most of us were like, no way does this thing pass. As one of the earlier speakers said, all you can do is count the yes votes. So anybody that voted no was a no. Anybody who didn't vote on the ballot initiative was a no as well. So you had a bit of a headwind already. And yet, this thing passed. It passed in spite of it being 2008. Think start of the recession. Think plunging stock market in October. This thing was going downhill. It was indeed a dark and stormy night. But we woke up that morning and found that it had passed in a 56% pass rate. It's a landslide for this type of thing, for ballot measure. Now, a word maybe for our California friends, we don't do ballot initiatives every year around here. We hardly ever have them. So this is a big deal. And it ended up passing. And out of it, we got this really cool-looking logo. So that was our first measure of progress. So that money that was coming out of that is about a third for wildlife habitat, a third for clean water, and the last third was split between parks and arts and culture. And the post-polling on how this thing happened showed that the greatest of these is water. By far, drove it. The wildlifers, or the blasters and casters, had been pushing quite a bit for the habitat funds, unsuccessfully for a number of years, and did a lot of work getting the word out and trying to get voters out on it and stuff. Parks came in there kind of near the end, and then a very influential senator who happened to chair a necessary committee in the process said, let's put the arts in there as well. So it was an odd coalition that came together, but enough of a coalition, enough of the bases covered, that the legislators were able to put it on the ballot. This was something the legislature enabled to happen. It wasn't a citizen petition to put it on the ballot. And so it ends up passing, and the things have been happening that you've been hearing about this morning, and a lot of which Shannon's going to cover right after me today about how the state's using that money as they address impaired waters. But it's important to know who led the charge on this. The three main speakers that were testifying at the legislature on why these monies were needed were a guy named Mike Robertson from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a guy named Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and the third one is a guy named Chris Raddus of the Farm Bureau, Minnesota Farm Bureau. Notice he didn't hear any of the enviro groups. They're there and they're talking and stuff, but the three main testifiers were those three. That was because the heritage on this thing came out of that water mindset a bit, but there was a definite, this is important for business perspective here. The Chamber of Commerce had taken a look at a report that had come out of the Legislative Auditor's Office that said, whoa, we've been hearing rumblings, probably coming a fair amount out of the Pollution Control Agency here, kind of going, hey, we've got to do TMDLs, and there's a bunch of lawsuits going on around the country. And rather than have development stunted or thwarted because the lawsuits are showing that if somebody wants to stop a wastewater expansion for more development, they can do it. And we better get on our horse, and that's why the Chamber of Commerce threw their support behind it and really, really pushed this along with the League of Minnesota Cities. The other undercurrent that was there was that type of fear that only another branch of government can instill. The executive branch was really worried what the judicial branch was going to do. In fact, the legislative branch was worried what the judicial branch was going to do. All it takes is a lawsuit to come in and get some sort of, I'll call it an adverse ruling. It doesn't even have to be an adverse. You get a ruling that results in some complex, convoluted, impossible to administer decision by a judge, and everything would get wrapped around the axle for a whole lot of people. And so there was a pretty palpable decision to everybody keep your powder dry for a bit. Let's see if we can't get something passed before we all start filing lawsuits left, right, and center. Our group is not the type to file lawsuits or anything. We weren't one of those considering a lawsuit, but there were groups out there talking along those lines. And as the discussion unfurled, you'll note a couple things on this slide. First thing is the year 2006. This thing, the money part passed in 2008. 2006 had already laid the policy groundwork saying, if you fund it, you know, if you build it, they will fund it type of thing is kind of what unfolded here. And the second thing I want to point out on this slide are the two bullets. One that's bolded that says implement restoration, which is the way government has of really doing a whole lot of action stuff on the ground sound boring. Implement restoration. The other one is protect unimpaired waters. You just heard Dan Stewart during their presentation this morning, and then about five times during the panel at the end, saying how we've got to get after protecting the waters that are still okay, since a great deal of Minnesota is still in good shape. Those two bullets were, I think, one of the things that helped carry it, in that the message was, we're not just going to do the paperwork. We're not going to do a TMDL and let it sit on the shelf, because, frankly, that's all you've got to do to keep EPA happy. Or maybe not happy, at least satisfied. Or at least out of your hair. Just do the TMDL, you're good. And the attitude here, both parties, all stakeholders, is if we're going to bother with this, let's do something different on the ground. And so that's why out of this money that's been coming out, so a third of this fund generates about $100 million a year for clean water. And about two-thirds of that, or $65 to $66 million bucks a year, is going for stuff that's making a difference on the ground. Again, this is a tie-in to a lot of your clientele. There's money, finally. You know, it used to be that there'd be people going, hey, have you considered doing this BMP or that BMP? Well, now they're going, I've got some money. Have you considered doing this BMP? It cuts down that lag time between a decision to, yeah, I want to do a project, and then maybe the Soil and Water District says, okay, hold that thought. I'll be back in like 2 years. I'm going to see if I can get some money to do it. It really closes that loop a lot quicker. And that's one thing that we've been hearing from producers is a very, very good thing. Because when they're ready to do it, when they're ready to fix that problem, if the money's there, it goes a lot faster. So I'm going to move on a little bit here to the next slide. This isn't exactly the title that MPCA had on the slide when I stole it from them, but making dots. Accountability was a huge, huge part of the discussions immediately after everything passed. Didn't come up a whole lot ahead of time, but all of a sudden everybody realized that this money was conspicuous. It's not base funding. It's a special fund. It's dedicated for this. And everybody was worried that the legislature would start diverting to different places. They were worried that the executive branch would spend it on dumb stuff. And they said, we want to be able to track this. So there's at least two different websites that pretty much track everything, everywhere where every cent is being spent and what's being accomplished with it. And so this map just shows 2010 to 2013, but the takeaway here is that these projects are actually on-the-ground projects, and they're popping up all over. And by the time this 25-year run ends, there should be a lot more dots there. The other thing you can see in this image is that you can kind of see how they tend to clump up a little bit. And that's been one of the other things that's come out of this, is that most of these funds are being put out not on a, oh, every county or every soil and water district gets an equal share, please do the right thing. It's on a competitive basis. And so those organizations that have got their act together, who have done planning like we saw from Crow Wing County here in the morning session, are able to say, we've done our homework, we've got our ducks in a row, we're ready to go, please fund us. Well, the flip side of that same coin is that if it's a really weak organization who likes to dream up things on Tuesday and try to fund them on Thursday, they're not doing so good. It's really creating a system of winners and losers, which the state hasn't quite figured out yet. So if you do decide to pursue something like this in your state, you might want to think about, are we okay with a conservation delivery system that starts looking a little bit like Swiss cheese? Because the weak operations are being exposed for what they are. And the strong operations are really just putting pedal to the metal and putting a lot of projects on the ground. One of those unintended consequences that's been interesting to see unfold. So one of the dynamics that's going on in the state as all this extra data has been coming out is, you know, kind of how are the cities doing, how are rural areas doing? Because that conversation has been coming up about people questioning how we're producing crops. The cities are sitting there. Remember, they were one of the people that pushed for the passage of the amendment, the League of Minnesota Cities. They're going, hey, we have dialed down our wastewater discharges big time. This is showing the phosphorus tonnage coming out of our biggest treatment plant in the Twin Cities, and how that's plummeted over time. The cities are also saying, We've also dialed down all the stuff coming out of our storm sewer systems. We're regulated for that. We've knocked it down. We heard this morning about some of those successes in that that have been seen around the state. I think TNC was talking about that. You take a look at the transparency data for lakes in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, about 90% of those are the same or better than they were 30 years ago. This is not a case where the urban area, which takes up about 6% of our state, is really the problem anymore. We've addressed a lot of those ends of pipes, be they industrial pipes or storm sewer pipes or wastewater treatment plant pipes. So then how are things going outside the cities? The Technicolor Green waterfall here, or algae fall here, is Minneopa Park down in southern Minnesota, and pictures like this circulate around a lot. Urban neighbors might have seen it, which is very surprising to me. And so one of the ways that we go about when I'm giving talks, I try to put up this slide and the next one that's coming about how do you explain it to people. Well, all my grandparents, both sets of grandparents, had farms in South Dakota. So I was, as a little kid, back and forth across the state all the time. And the landscape was different back then. You think of countryside, it was green. As we heard from several speakers this morning, it spends a lot of time not green because of the way the crops have shifted. So this is one of the themes that TNC covered, I think, a little bit this morning, but since his hard drive had exploded on him, here's your first visual proof of it. So what you're looking at here is a graph that was put together by the Science Museum staff. They're taking a look at what the ground cover is, how the ground cover has changed since essentially World War I up to today. So yeah, there beans appear just after World War II and start essentially displacing hay and small grains. Corn has been fairly steady. So the big difference on that is it has increased the amount of runoff. We've had less evapotranspiration and a little bit more of what Bruce was describing as more the leaky sort of crop coverage. And that leaky is going through the tiling system, which is in and isn't coming out and really helps productivity, so why would it come out? But there's a couple of compelling storylines here that I'll wrap up with. First off, I think everybody here knows about the Des Moines lawsuit that's going on, Des Moines Water Utility, where they're taking a look at the lawsuit, the watersheds draining, the watersheds upstream of Des Moines' 500,000 water customers. Turns out those 500,000 water customers don't like paying more, don't like to incur downstream costs for upstream decisions. This lawsuit is going to shape the discussion that all of us in our professions here are going to be dealing with for the next decade as the court case unfolds and as the appeals happen and as friends of the court briefs are filed on both sides, and it's going to be a great big contested match. Why does Des Moines care so much? Because we've all seen this sort of thing. They've got that westernmost dark spot is where they are. Got a lot of tile, and so as the leaky system is there, we've got a mechanism for delivering it. It's not news to anybody. So, as David said this morning, clearly we've got an altered system. It's going to stay altered, so we got to find those ways to make it happen. And because of the money that we've got available in this state, we now have a really good data set. And the whole he said, she said, or that was collected 30 years ago by some corrupt official. I mean, we've got decades and decades and decades now of data that's being finally collected, but analyzed and explained and figured out. So when the Pollution Control Agency puts together this graphic, which will probably, one more slide here, puts together this graphic and talks to you in a few minutes about it, the shorthand for this is, yes, we know that there's more nitrogen and red is bad and yellow is okay and green is good. Well, that's farm country, transition country, farther north up to forested lands. We've got similar maps for phosphorus and for sediment. Coloration's about the same. And it's not that the numbers are that, the relative numbers are that important. It's that fact it's been backed up. It's not just monitoring data. It's a couple different tracks of monitoring. It's a couple different tracks of modeling that have come at it. It's a couple different things looking at fertilizer sales data, like Bruce was talking about. There's a lot of lines of evidence, and you can probably poke a hole in any one of them over something or another, but the preponderance of the evidence is this map's it's in the zone. So we are very, very fortunate to have had that money around to be able to document this stuff so that we don't crack down in the wrong places, that we don't spend our resources in an area where we don't get the best return on the investment. What tells us that if the state ought to be trying to focus a bit more of their dollars down in the red areas, if they want to get the most nutrient removal per dollar. We know where we need to work, which leads me to the second and the final thing that's going on around here. Buffers. Governor Dayton, back on January 16th, 2015, pretty much stunned everybody except the DNR commissioner, who he told about the night before that he was going to make a big push last legislative session to put in require vegetated buffers. And he wanted them by the rivers, the streams, the creeks, the ditches, the private ditches, the wetlands, the lakes, a whole big schmear. And so he threw this out on the world and said it may be private land, but it's public's water. And things went in motion very quickly. And I know you guys all know what this is, but you know, there's what it is. Here's an artist's rendition of what it would turn into. One more time, because this is the only action portion of this presentation. Just a little buffer. Or to be more precise, just a little area that's neither paved nor plowed. It doesn't have to be native turf, native prairie or native veg. It can be alfalfa, it can be hay. Point is, get something growing, get some ground cover. It's exactly what at least three of our speakers this morning talked about, which is get something there that's living cover, that takes up, ties up that nitrogen and keeps it available for production eventually. So, governor announces this. A lot of people form into teams, start lobbying. And what passed was pretty close to current law, but on a faster timetable. The governor did not get everything he was going for. It's very, very close to what the law is that's on the books. But it provided some money now for greater enforcement and to actually essentially say, we mean it this time. We need to get these buffers in. And so that's moving. So graphically, what we've got going on is from left to right, the governor launches his idea. It passes. There's all this hope that things are going to go wonderful. And now people are arguing about what did we actually pass. There's a couple of lines of thought where, well, we didn't mean that. Well, here's what it says in the bill, but that's not what we were talking about. We're about to go into one hell of a trough of disillusionment here as we try to figure out which waters this does and does not apply to. And that'll likely have a little bit of smoothing that needs to happen this session or the following session. It's not the end of the world. We're going to pick up some more buffers. It's a step forward. But as I think Bruce answered this morning, these buffers aren't a panacea. They're not going to fix everything. I mean, a lot of them have tile lines going underneath them anyway. But it's a start, it's a little bit of something, and the cool thing about the law is that it has a portion of it that says alternative practices can be used if they can provide better nutrient removal than just going with that straight 50-foot thing. So I think by the time we get that applied and start using it, we're at a point where something productive is going to come out of this. So whereas we can all sit and say, well, the science of buffers are pretty clear. We know that you a little more removals for water quality, the farther you go out, pretty soon you start pick up some additional habitat things. That part's easy, but the policy aspects of it and how does it mean which waters are under the jurisdiction and how does districts, soil and water districts, tasked in this law with working with landowners, how do they best approach landowners on how to do this? And what they've told us is that they have three big fears. One is that the politicians will stab them in the back. locally and say, oh, we don't support this at all, and leave them hung out to dry as they do what the law says. Their second fear is that the funding will dry up. We've got 2 years of it right now. Their fear is that if they staff up to do this, start telling farmers they need to do this, all of a sudden 2 years from now the money goes away and it's like their credibility is shot because no longer is anybody following up on this. And those who did comply will feel like, why do I have to comply and these other people don't? The last of their three big fears is that the state guidance will come out pretty fuzzy. And a landowner that maybe has land straddling a county line gets one answer from County A and a different answer from County B. It's not that uncommon of a situation, and it is a very, very real fear of the people at the ground level who have to stand at the planning and zoning counter or at the service center and field questions from landowners. I see that I'm about at the finishing time here. Don, do you have any time for questions, or you just want me to get out of here? I've got a couple minutes if there are any questions, preferably easy ones. I'm seeing none locally, Don. That's like the fifth time you've kind of said something about long in the tooth, so.
So if you had to predict how the upper guidance is going to go, what do you see coming?
The law requires the DNR to produce a map that is essentially idiot-proof, which is a challenge. That literally you can look at it and say, this piece of water is in need of a buffer or it is not. It's within the jurisdiction or it is not. The fight is going to be about how those are defined. What we've seen in the state is that there's been a handful of counties who have actively gone out and promoted compliance with what the laws have been. So over the last handful of years before this new legislation. And time after time, what those counties have found out is that they get 80% compliance pretty much like with the first letter. They write a second letter, they get another 10% compliance. And it just kind of keeps halving as it goes. By the time they're up to their third letter and their first site visit, they've only got a couple percentage left of people who don't comply. Landowners pretty much are going, this isn't a big deal, but be fair. Keep it in an even playing field. I'll do it if everybody else does it. And don't make me fill out any more forms than I possibly have to. They don't want that extra exposure to government, whatever the level of government. And it has just really been not that painful if it's set up well. And I think there's been enough counties that have done this in the last handful of years that there's some good models out there. And we're seeing a fair amount of peer-to-peer learning or experience trading around those. And I think that'll help prepare those organizations for which this work is new. You know, taking such steps as, what do you do if the guy comes out with a shotgun and says, get off my land? What do you do if he says, well, the other county didn't make me do it here? Run people through some scenarios, some role-playing, so that they not only have the technical aspects of it down cold, but they've got the social, they've got the public relations part of it down cold. Because it's really easy to get to lose your reputation as somebody who's there to work with landowners when you have to be within this realm or within the orbit of a regulatory system, which this buffer thing is. And the districts are worried about being perceived as somehow they're not the white hat, they're now wearing the black hat. And there's an art to answering questions that helps you keep your white a little less smudged, your white hat a little less smudged. Thank you for your time, everybody.
Uh,
does any other state have anything remotely similar to Minnesota? There are a couple things. I'm going to answer that in two different ways. The other speaker this morning, I think it was Dan Stewart, talked about how Minnesota had invested in local capacity in the 1980s. So we've had this nice three-decade run-up of saying we don't want a bunch of extra state employees, you know, another floor on the DNR and another floor on the pollution control building. We've been saying, let's get the people out in the county offices, let's get the people out in the soil and water conservation district offices. And so the legislature has provided the authorities and the ability for them to fund and go after their own water priorities. Think bottom up, what their local priorities are. And having that capacity out there has been a wonderful thing to build off of. That's how you see these success stories, like the Crow Wing example we saw. You don't just start out of the gate with a project of that magnificence. It takes a while to build up to that. The second part of my answer is going to address the legacy fund thing. From a legacy standpoint, we've seen, obviously, Missouri, I think, was one of the first ones that really passed something that had that sales tax revenue to come in and do a lot of good things. I've heard Iowa passed one, but it has not been subsequently funded by the legislature. And I believe last year there was one up in North Dakota that I think went down in flames. I'm seeing head nods here. Unsuccessfully landed. So we're not the only one, but we sure love the way we've structured ours to make sure we accomplish a lot of this water quality improvements that essentially the EPA mandates and sets off a cascade of responsibilities to lower levels of government. Again, thank you once again for your time.